the last time Pastor Wolfmuller and I spoke, we started a new corner, a new edge to our wolfscatology that is just really, you know, looking at the end of the world, eschatology conversation by trying to get deep into Matthew 24 and 25. We may end up, you know, going past the parables a little quickly, but trying to figure out what this text is really about, and at least starting with the assumption that it has something to do with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. It isn't all about the end of the world, the way that most modern day end times watchers would try to have you believe it to be so. And we established at least one main point from my position on this, which is that as Jesus is leaving the temple and the disciples say, look how great this temple is, he says, you know, it's going to all be torn down. They then follow him and they ask him two questions, but they think it's one question. They think it's about the end of the world, that the temple is going to be torn down at the end of the world. And so they say, what's going to be the sign of your coming and when will these things happen? And he gives two answers. One is what the signs are that this thing is going to happen, the temple is going to be torn down, and then what the signs are for the end of the world. And there aren't any. And that's kind of the key thing, right? So that whatever we take out of this, we got to know that there is nothing that remains to be done before the world ends. Jesus can come back at any moment like a thief in the night. It's going to be, you know, as lightning lights up the sky, all that good stuff. But we're not waiting on something for that to happen. And Pastor Wolfmuller and I are fully agreed, I think, on everything I just said so far, even though as we get into the narrows of Matthew 24, there's some edge moments where my textual move to say all of it's about those days and then all of this over here is about that day may not be something he's quite on board with yet, which is also, as you're listening here, I'm going to give him a chance to respond to what I've just said, but as you're listening here, this is a great example of how much freedom we have as Lutherans, as Bible-believing, Scripture-alone, confessional, dogmatic Lutherans, to disagree about things that Scripture says, especially the passages that are less than clear, because of the solidarity we have in the things that are clear, which is should destroy our pride a little bit and let us be able to kind of be humiliated with each other and say, I don't know. I don't know what this means. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm not. Here, how does this impact the gospel? How does this impact Word and Sacrament ministry? Let's let, our theology lead us, and you can actually land in places where, as long as your theology is fine, what you do with the given text may or may not matter all that much. Not to say that Scripture doesn't matter, right? But that the unclear passage can be unclear, and this is wonderful. It's a place of faith alone. What are your thoughts on any of that to open up today, Pastor Wolfmuller Bryan?
I think that's exactly right, and I think you hit the points of agreement really well. And in fact, I think we can clarify the points where we don't yet agree to be very narrow points. But I think I've got my head around them. But to just kind of reemphasize what you said is that that Matthew 24 is talking. Jesus answering two questions: when will the temple be destroyed, and when will you come back? And those apparently are two different events. The temple was destroyed at last on August the 10th in AD 70, and we're still waiting for the Lord's return in glory. Now, I think that both of those events, the temple being destroyed and the Lord's second coming, are discussed in this text as the Lord's visitation. So as we see that day coming and the destruction coming, we have to identify, is it talking about the day that the temple is destroyed, or is it talking about the last day when the dead are raised and so forth? And then the other place where we just to look at the text to see what it applies to is that some of these texts will apply to the time before the destruction of the temple. In other words, unlike the second coming, Jesus is going to give specific indications to the Christians living in Jerusalem about what they are to look out for before the temple is destroyed. And in fact, we know from history that the church heeded those warnings and they left Jerusalem, so that the histories tell us that no Christians, in fact, died in the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. It's amazing, because they understood these words of Jesus and booked it out of town. Some texts, and I think this is where we got into it last time, some texts, I think, are going to be an indication of how it will be between the destruction of Jerusalem and the second coming. In other words, they're not going to be signs of the end, but they're going to be kind of descriptions of how it's going to be always. And I think that's when we got into it in a few verses that you saw as signs of the destruction of Jerusalem, and I saw as kind of indications from the Lord about how things will always be. So our disagreement on these texts are very narrow, but I think they're also intriguing to kind of dig into a little bit and to push on each other some.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that I don't think the things that are happening in verses 4 through 14 aren't also things that will always be, right? These things which he calls the beginning of birth pains, I don't think they started with the apostolic band either. I think these things go all the way back. I don't know how much I don't blame you if you haven't listened to any of what I've done in Revelation, but I'm convinced the four horsemen of the apocalypse, it's just silly we call them that. It's a fluke of history that we call them that. They're the four horsemen of the curse. They're the things that have been going on from the fall onward. They're the creation in rebellion and receiving its meet punishment in its own rebelliousness. And this is very much just another perspective on that, with the one exception being, you know, verse 9 there, where it says that they will deliver you up and put you to death, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. I think when he's saying this to these 11 or 12 guys, that there's a very specific sign of that reality, which the Acts event, the Pentecost event, certainly brings to bear. And so that they are really to know, as they're being chained in Jerusalem, look, the temple is going to be destroyed pretty soon here, right? And we're not necessarily to look for that as a sign of anything coming in the future now. Persecution of Christians is not going to ramp up as the last day gets closer, but this is kind of your point. It's just always going to be there, right? And the apostles were, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians, they were examples for the world. They were scoffed at a higher level in some ways, and it was written down for us so that we would see, you know, that friendship with the world is enmity with God and all that kind of stuff. So, like you said, the disagreement is pretty narrow. Although it may be there in a really, you know, hard exegetical mold, if I can say that.
Yes, yeah, which is right. But the main point being, which is I think the main thing that you and I both want to emphasize, is that this text should not be read as fortune telling for the second coming. That's the great danger of this text, is that we, you know, these great natural disasters happen. And then we say, oh, it must be that the end is near. Or, you know, there's an eclipse, or there's a war. In other words, we're looking around at the things that are happening, and we want to equate those with the second coming. That is the wrong way to read the scriptures. And I think we've made that point fairly clear. And that is, I think, the main kind of thing that we want to drive at as we push through this text.
Well, as we move past verse 14, I think we really do then, and I think we'd agree with this, we turn a corner into something pretty significant, which I'm going to say, from my point of view, this is the sign that the temple's going to be destroyed. We are now moving into something that we shouldn't look to be repeated as some sort of proof of anything. Not that it can't have kind of ripples, the way, you know, you throw a rock into a pool and it's got the ripples that go going out, and there's like smaller versions. I think you see ripples of the effect of what we're going to see happening here. But I don't think we should be looking for a particular one again, because it already has happened. And there's certainly some debate about what that was, although I'm pretty convinced of one thing myself. But to do this also, we're going to have to spend some time looking at Daniel a little more closely. And I said this to you, Brian, before we started talking, but I should say it to the listener too. And if they're a Ref Escrow listener, they know, I've admitted this before, you know, the prophets are a gaping hole in my theological education. And I don't want to, you know, directly attack the seminary I went to, but honestly, it was kind of a blank spot in the curriculum so far as when I went through it. And so I'm continuing to read these things as I prepare for the Revelation commentaries, really enjoying that. But Daniel's not one I've dug deeply into yet, and I've actually kind of, I don't want to until I can give full attention to the thing. Although I do have some I would call linchpin ideas that I think are pretty important because of this text. And so we're gonna go back and forth with this a little bit. I'm hoping Brian's gonna teach me a few things here as well as we look at Daniel. But I'm just gonna go ahead and read a bit of the text, verse 15 and following. Let's see, what do I have as my notes here? 15 to 28 is the whole segment. And it's quite long. We'll see. We'll see how far we get. So it says, after he's talked about, you know, the persecution of Christians in Jerusalem and wars and rumors of wars having really no meaning whatsoever and whether or not the end is near, he does say then, so when you see the abomination of desolation, that's the key phrase right there. That's what we're going to be talking about. Abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. So you need to go look it up. He's going to talk to you and Daniel about what it is. Standing in the holy place. Now, then it's even weirder. Let the reader understand. So Jesus is discoursing and he's talking about the reader understanding, or is this Matthew saying, now slow down and try to figure this out. I would say that's Matthew there saying, if you're reading this, don't go too fast here, but what is that holy place? Got to define that. Then when you see this, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And actually, I'm going to stop right there because what follows next is like him exhorting them on the basis of what he's just said. But if you get this part wrong, it really doesn't do you any good because it can't really be applied. So can we agree? I think we can agree that the abomination of desolation is something we have to look at the book of Daniel to figure out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to agree with you all the way on this one that this is the Lord warning his Christian church in Jerusalem very specifically. You're going to see something, and when you see that, run for it. And again, to kind of repeat the historical point, the Christians understood that, and they saw it, and they ran for it, and they survived the siege of Jerusalem, which was one of the worst events to occur in history. So you're exactly right. So to Daniel we go.
Well, and let's define one more term here before we go to Daniel. I think that this word holy place, and if I were really on my game, I'd have the Greek here. I can find it to the side here just a moment. That's not right. Where are you? 15. Let the reader understand. Say again?
Topo hagio.
Where can I find it in my Greek? Oh, there we go. Okay. Yeah. So it is literally just the place of holiness, which, see, right. it could have been, I guess, helpful if he'd just used the word temple. but at the same time, in the Hebrew mind, there's only one holy place. It is the temple on the mountain of Jerusalem, at the center of which is the most holy place, right? Where the Ark of the Covenant should be set. It wasn't set there at this time. And so... this holy place needs to be understood, at least in the narrow here. I'm not talking about the ripples. I think there's ripples to this. But in the narrow, he is talking about that something that Daniel prophesies is going to happen in the temple itself, and that's the sign. Are you with me on that too?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So, well, then thus it is established. Brian and Jonathan agree. Let the disagreeer tremble, right? Let him fear. So let's jump to, again, Daniel 9, verse 27. We're going to actually go back and look at 24 leading up to it. If you want to, while you're getting there, if you're following along at home, we're going to look at Daniel 9, 24 to 27. We're going to jump to Daniel 11, 29 to 35. We'll try not to leave it contextless as we do that. And then we're going to look at Daniel 12, 8 to 13. All of this basically preparing the way for understanding this phrase, abomination of desolation, again, we'll try to put some flesh on that by the end of this as well in terms of what we think that was about or when it did happen leading up to that August 10th destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So, Brian, I'm going to throw this your way, though, because honestly, I was unprepared to go to Daniel 9. We talked about that off the air here. And so I want to have you lead us through this and kind of walk our way toward why is this important for understanding the abomination of desolation?
Well, the first thing maybe is to just remember that the last half of Daniel is very, you know, people love to read Daniel because it has the fiery furnace and has Daniel in the lion's den in the beginning, and it's great, and you see these great examples of resisting idolatry. But then you get halfway through it, and the visions and dreams of Daniel become very, very specific and very historical, perhaps more so than any other prophet, so that Daniel is going to be laying out the succession of kingdoms, of the eras that are to come, the Babylonians giving way to the Medo-Persians, giving way to the Greeks, giving way to the Romans, and then comes the Messiah and his eternal kingdom, which like a stone rolls over all the other kingdoms. And in fact, in this Daniel 9, we get this famous prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel, which is, I think, even by the Lutherans, really by everyone, taken as a a sort of a timeline that Daniel's going to give between the prophecy and in fact, the edict to rebuild Jerusalem and all the things that are going to happen at the end. So the 70 weeks are understood to be weeks of years. So there's going to be 490 years between the rebuilding of the temple and the what is going to happen at the end, the abomination of desolation. And all the folks look at this and try to sort it out into the timeline. I'll tell you what how Luther sorts it out, and I think it's right what he does here. But what the thing is, we do have to shift gears a little bit for Daniel, because to understand him in context is to understand him laying out a future chronology of the events that are going to happen leading up to the death and resurrection of Jesus.
I think it's important to jump in just on the weeks of years thing. This has to do with the fact that it some texts say not weeks, but sevens. Is it? It's not Sabbath that's there is the word, but it's 77s. And yet seven is a number that's important in the Bible because of the week and because of the Sabbath day and all this. And so it can be translated as weeks. It can be translated as sevens. And the question is, well, and the reason why nobody really argues about this point, I don't think, is because it obviously wasn't 70 weeks. Daniel was just wrong if it was 70 weeks, right? But if you put it in the perspective of years, you have not only a prophecy connected to the restoration of the temple, but I think, at least from what I remember from my reading, and I'm drawn on 15 years ago now, you actually have it leading up to right around the time of Jesus' crucifixion, right? You even have a timeline for that. Now, the issue also, though, is that this is where some of the dispensational stuff goes really awry, because Jesus' crucifixion somehow splits one of these weeks in half, and I don't know if I know this well enough either, and they're kind of waiting for the last half of one of the weeks, or they need another week to happen. Is that right? Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, so the 70 weeks here are divided into, you have 69 weeks, and then you have a 70th week, and so that 70th week would be a time of 3 years, or sorry, a time of 7 years. The way the dispensationalists do it is they put the crucifixion of Jesus, the triumphal entry of Jesus, is the end of the 69th week, and they say there is then a pause between the 69th and the 70th week, and we're in that pause or in that comma now, and that starts back up, that 70 weeks of Daniel starts back up at the rapture, and you have the 7 years of great tribulation, 3.5 years of peace, 3.5 years of trouble, and so forth. So the way the dispensationalist counts it is you have 69 weeks, the crucifixion of Jesus, and then you have 3.5 years of peace, 3.5 years of trouble, and then the end. Luther will outline it like this, and this lines up with most classical exegetes of the scripture in the church, is that the 69 weeks prophesy very precisely the time until the baptism of Jesus. And then you have 3.5 years between the baptism of Jesus and the crucifixion of Jesus. And then you have 3.5 years between the crucifixion of Jesus and the stoning of St. Stephen. Hmm. And so that it's that stoning of St. Stephen when the official persecution of the church begins that marks the end of the 70th week. And it's at that point that the Lord's determination to destroy the temple is kind of reached its full point. And so I think that's a beautiful way to understand the prophecy that's going on here.
It is beautiful, especially because it was this 70-week thing that proved to me how diabolical premillennial dispensationalism is, because the reason that they put the pause at 69 weeks is because Jesus died, and that was wrong. This was not supposed to happen. He was supposed to reign from Jerusalem. And it blows my mind as a Christian, not just as a Lutheran, as a Christian, that you could ever think that the cross was an error and the church is plan B. There is nothing more wicked I could imagine teaching or putting at the center of a systematic theology than that idea. And yet that is the reason for the interlude of the weeks, which pushes you all the way to doing all this other stuff with the rapture. Down in the nugget, down in the core of this thing is, well, the cross was a mistake.
Yeah, that's right. It was plan B. When the Jewish people rejected the Messiah, then God had to decide what he wanted to do, and that's when he decided to die on the cross. That's really bad.
It's evil.
There's a modified dispensationalism that wants to, that just doesn't want to say that because they realize how bad that is, but it's there. It's in the DNA of dispensationalism to despise the humiliation of the cross of Christ. And you see it even in the thinking that, well, when Jesus comes back in glory, then we'll see him how he really is, instead of recognizing that when we see Jesus dying on the cross, we are seeing God as he really is. I mean, that's our truest glimpse of God.
Yeah.
So this despising of the cross kind of runs all the way through this dispensationalism.
So Gabriel comes to Daniel and he brings him a message. You know, Daniel, I have come to give you insight and understanding. This is what he leads up to verse 24. In verse 24, he says, 70 sevens are decreed about your people and your holy city. Now, I got to hear that your people as, in fact, the Hebrew people, people of the bloodline of Abraham. 70 sevens are decreed to do what? To finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both the vision and the prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Now, the initial things there, I think, really are very much synonyms for each other. They're the same thing, right? So to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, that is a threefold declaration that he's going to destroy evil, right? But how? By atoning for it, by paying for it. You know, he doesn't say by dying on the cross, but that's effectively what he's getting at here. 77s are decreed from your people, the Jews, until this happens, which will bring in everlasting righteousness. Now, I think this is key here too, and I'm gonna lean on that Judish book I'm always recommended of the Claims of the Charismatic Gifts to seal both the vision and the prophet. This is, I think, to put an end to prophecy. That after this is done, we have no more need for prophecy, which puts the New Testament era kind of the end of that reality. And to anoint a most holy place, this is when Jesus says, you know, the days are coming when you will not worship on this mountain, but you will worship in spirit and truth. The most holy place now is this new resurrected body of mankind in the person of Jesus. Verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, here that is Christ, right? Of the Christ, of the Messiah, a prince, the king, Jesus, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks, it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. Now here, actually, I may have just spoken erroneously, and I'm going to slow down so that you can jump in on this. But basically, pulling Isaiah to bear a little bit here, from the time that Cyrus, king of Persia, gives up the word, rebuild Jerusalem, there is going to be a single week, 7 years, until the coming of an anointed one, and then 62 weeks while it's being built again. But I just said that anointed one was Jesus. So who are we talking about there?
No. So read it like this. There'll be 7 weeks. So that's 7 times 7, 49 years. So from the time that we have the edict to go back to Jerusalem, you're going to have building for 49 years, and then you're going to have 62 weeks. That's 62 times 7. I don't know what the math is. That the city will be established, and then the Messiah will come. So he's saying, from the time of the edict to go back until the Messiah is revealed, you have 69 weeks. 69 times 7, and so that Messiah, the Prince, is Christ. Do you see how it's there?
I think so. I just wish we'd translated a little more clearly. And I'm sure it's because, I mean, Hebrew is tough, and then Aramaic is tougher, and then poetry is tough, and then prophecy is tougher, and it's Daniel on top of it all. So I'm sure that the actual language is pretty tough here.
So it's so something like this. No one understand from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, will come, there'll be 7 weeks and 62 weeks.
Hmm.
So there's going to be 69 weeks between the edict to return and the return of the Messiah.
So the question I would have is, why the split? Why 7 and 62? Why not just 69?
Yeah, I think the 7 refers to the building of Jerusalem, and the 62 refers to the standing of Jerusalem. So it says, the street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublesome times. So the 7 refers to the building of the city. And then the 62 weeks is going to refer to the standing of the city of Jerusalem.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the best I can do on that one.
So you effectively, though, have this prophecy for, it's not 490 years, right? It's 483 years, something like that. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So 490 minus 7, 483, yep.
And after the 62 weeks plus the 7 from before, right? So at the end of this time period, an anointed one, right, the Messiah, a Christ, shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And this is why we're like, look, it was fulfilled, right? This isn't, the cross was not an oops. He is coming to be cut off from his people, to cry out, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, that's interesting. What does that mean? Its end shall come with the flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. Now, this is like, okay, I don't know about the people of the prince who is to come, unless, and maybe that's why I want to go look at the kings of the north and the south, but clearly this is the temple is going to be, or the Jerusalem itself is going to be destroyed. Desolations are decreed, right? The abomination of desolation. And in the meantime, he shall make a strong covenant with many. Think of the New Testament in my blood. For 1:7, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. Again, complicated text. Why don't you do that one first?
Yeah, so it's interesting to note that the Messiah shall be cut off. Could be literally that the Messiah will suffer the death penalty.
Yeah.
And that's the key here. And then, so we have 69 weeks until the Messiah comes. And then there's 1 week, the last of the 70th week. And in that 1 week, it says he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Mm. In the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and an offering. And then on the wings of an abomination shall be one who makes desolate. So you have the last week of this promised 69 weeks. Now, again, Luther sorts this out. In fact, he does all the math and does a bunch of calendar work to sort this out, and it works out really nicely. That 69th week, the 70th week, begins with the baptism of Jesus. And then in the middle of the week, so 3.5 years later, he brings an end to sacrifice and offering. That means his death on the cross.
Right.
So when Jesus is filling up all of the preaching of the temple, he's filling up the preaching of all of the sacrifices of the Old Testament. He's filling up the blood of every bull and every goat that was ever shed on Jewish altars. Jesus is making an end to sacrifice because every sacrifice pointed to him. And when he says it is finished, he is including all of the preaching of the goats and the lambs of the Old Covenant. And so that happens 3.5 years later. So that marks the middle of that week, the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Then the tricky part is to say, well, what 3.5 years later, what happens? And it looks like the closest thing we can get to that would be the stoning of Stephen. And we're able to calculate the date of that kind of amazingly enough because Stephen was stoned, and we know that it was illegal for people to be stoned in Jerusalem. I mean, stoning was the way that the Lord had determined that capital punishment should be exercised.
But outside the camp, right?
Yeah, that's right. But the Romans had made that illegal. So when the Romans occupied a place, one of the things that they did was they said, we will be the executors of capital punishment, which is why Jesus was crucified and not stoned to death. But it looks like 3.5 years after the death of Jesus, there was a little window where the governor, Pontius Pilate was out and the other governor of Judea had not come in. And in that little window, there would have been a space for the Jews to, in fact, stone someone without themselves getting crucified. Hmm. And so this helps us date the martyrdom of St. Stephen by stoning. And so it looks like the chronology sorts out precisely that way. And what we see then in the rest of the Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy is that stoning of St. Stephen is understood to be the beginning of the judgment of Jerusalem, so that now the wings of the prince who will bring the abomination that makes desolate are starting to flap in the air. And it's only, 25 or 30 years later that, in fact, he arrives to utterly destroy not only all of Jerusalem, but most especially the temple, where one stone is not left upon another.
Mm. Yeah. So that's part one. moving forward, and here's where we're gonna fly by night a little bit here. I have as my notes that Daniel chapter 11, verses 29 to 35, has something to do with where we're going as well. But we're kind of skipping over this section of the kings of the South and the North, which, if I'm getting this right, this is a vision of two of the four different kings which are prophesied. No, I'm wrong about that. It's either two of the four different kings that are prophesied to come as various animals, and they kind of beat each other up, and the statue with the golden head and the bronze feet, or not the bronze feet, the clay feet, is that, or it's a prophecy of some fights that are going on simply in the intertestamental period between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, right? And I think that's right. So maybe you're just gonna smash us all, but right. So you have the four kingdoms which are going to come. You have Babylon, you have Persia, you have the Greeks, and then you have the Romans. But in the middle of the Greeks, after the strong man Alexander the Great kind of spreads the Greek world, he dies and he leaves the world to the strongest of his generals. In fact, this is a great story. You know, when he dies, they're asking him, you know, who's going to be the one to rule after you? And he says, the strongest. And so basically he leaves them to fight. It ends up with four different kingdoms. You hear about these in various groups, all the way, you know, even Cleopatra is connected to this in the Ptolemaic Empire, all this stuff. But so the Ptolemies are down in Egypt. The Seleucids are up kind of northeast. And so you got Judea caught in the middle, and that whole intertestamental period is about their fight between each other. And I think this Kings of the North and South is that fight going on. And in the middle of that, there's going to be something else that impacts the abomination desolation. But I want to see what you think about what I just said, and if I just made stuff up, or if it's close.
I'm guessing that you're right. I don't remember that.
I know I'm right about the last words of Alexander the Great, but the rest of it, I think that's what's going on here. And this is where this book just needs so much time to look into it. So in the middle of this Seleucid Ptolemaic controversy, where the Maccabees arise and they throw off, there's some freedom for a little while and all this stuff. One of the, and I forget which one of them it is, but verse 36 is telling us one of those kings of those two little mini empires, the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt, and this is Antiochus Epiphanes, I think is his name, right? He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. And this is like the prototypical abomination of desolation, where he does something to the temple, and I can't remember what that is. But 37 says, he shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many, and shall divide the land for a price. Now, I think what's important there is that this is why the abomination of desolation is not Antiochus Epiphanes. Because what this guy does, this king does, is he does desecrate the temple a little bit. I think historically he brings some images into the temple, and that this is indeed prophesied, but it's not the final thing. And oh man, I hope I'm right about this. This is where Daniel's just so dangerous, because if you're wrong, you're super wrong. So how are you doing on this stuff so far? Are you just like as lost as I am?
Yeah, I'm tracking it down. I found I found the reference to Antiochus, so here's the quote. I think this must be from Josephus. It says Antiochus, on his way home from Egypt, sent Apollonius with 20,000 men to destroy Jerusalem, 2 years after its capture by himself. Apollonius slew multitudes, dismantled and pillaged the city. The soldiers then, from a fortress which they built commanding the temple, fell on and slew the worshippers, so that the temple service was discontinued. And Antiochus decreed that all, on pain of death, should conform to the Greek religion, and the temple was consecrated to Jupiter. Identifying himself with this god, Antiochus, with fanatical haughtiness, wished to make his own worship universal.
Which, since he's a Greek, Jupiter, like, doesn't make any sense, right? So he's, yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Go ahead. I shouldn't have cut you off.
So anyway, that's the reference to this. Now, I think the point is going to be that that when Jesus is talking about the abomination of desolation that is to come, he's referencing back the abomination of desolation, which happened already. So when Jesus is saying, when Jesus uses that language, the abomination of desolation, He's pointing us back to Daniel to understand what happened already that Daniel prophesied, but what's going to happen again next, that there's going to be that that the temple of God is going to be handed over to pagan worship. But specifically this, and this wasn't in the Josephus quote, but that this is going to be accomplished with the collusion of the priests, so that the abomination of desolation is not just that the temple is overrun by force, but that even before that the priests have allowed it to happen. So the priests have taken payment from the pagans to bring them into the temple to offer pagan sacrifices. So we had that hinted in at the prophecy here, and I think we'll have it hinted in again later in Daniel and then also in Matthew.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and that makes sense of everything I was saying before. It ties it up nicely, so my memory's not totally gone. The rest of chapter 11, then, is more about this individual king of the Seleucid Empire, and then chapter 12 begins by shifting the direction. So there's going to be a change. Michael, the great prince, is going to arise. And I'm not sure I followed this either. But basically, you got to hear this saying is that the temple sacrifices that are false will be put to an end. And you're going to have a restoration of true religion taking place. At least I think that's what's going on where in verse 1 where it says, at that time your people shall be delivered. And you got some resurrection language here, though, that's just interesting. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. That makes it sound like judgment day, so I kind of get that. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever. So maybe that is, you know, judgment day. Like after this... Well, I guess I'm going to step back. This is where some, I think, would say that Michael is actually a reference here to Jesus, right? And I'm not sure I'm really comfortable with that. So either way, we have the delivery of Jerusalem, whether it's from Antiochus' false religion or whether it's Jesus for the entire world. That's the big idea here. But Daniel's supposed to shut all this up and seal the words of the book, which means we're going to have trouble understanding it. But then there's a little bit more that takes place, right? In verse 5, Daniel, I looked, and behold, two others stood, one on the bank of the stream and one on the bank of the stream, either side of the river. And someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, how long shall it be until the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever that it would be time, times, and half a time, which I think is apocalyptic language for it'll be the right amount of time, so stop wondering. And that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, that's the destruction of Jerusalem, all these things would be finished. So that's where it's like, is it the end of the world? I heard, but I did not understand. Then I said, oh Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things? Because even Daniel's like, I don't get what's going on. God, it's too much. It's fire hose. Turn the fire hose off. And he says to Daniel, go your way, for the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. That is, Daniel, you're not going to be able to understand this. This is one of the rare times I'm going to give a prophecy that's only about the future, and you cannot comprehend it. But many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall act wickedly. So expect things to go on as they have. And none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. That is, us now looking back, we can actually pinpoint some of this stuff, right? And from the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up. Now, that's the piece Jesus is referencing in Matthew 24. We're doing all this to try to understand what he's saying here. There shall be 1,290 days. Okay, we'll come back to that. Blessed is he who waits and arrives at the 1,335 days. That's an extra 45 days. But, Daniel, you go your way till the end, and you shall rest and shall stand in your allotted place at the end of days. Amen. End of book. Right? What? That didn't help. I want to go back. What do you think about the Michael part? I mean, is this the end of the world? Is this Jesus coming at the appointed time? Is it both? I think that's a big part of what leads into this.
I think so. First, with Michael, that Michael is always working with messianic authority, which I think you make that point. Some people have identified Michael and Jesus. I think it's really quite beautiful to understand Michael as a named archangel, ruler of the Lord's people, who is a creature who is able to exercise divine authority. So when Michael shows up in Revelation 12 and removes the devil, we see that Jesus, you know, here's the devil, our great enemy, who is the most intimidating of all foes. And Jesus who could remove him says, "Ah, I'll let one of my creatures remove him."
Right,
I mean,
right.
and it's really quite beautiful that Michael is able to receive the authority of the Messiah. And so I think we
I want to jump in on that because I want to affirm it, and then you draw the dots to the cross after this. But I want to share something I can't prove, but I really think it's true. Although it could be really bad, I suppose. But isn't it weird? And this I can't take credit for this either. A good friend of mine, Mark Payne, is the one who showed me this idea. Isn't it weird that there's only two named archangels in the Bible? And you can go to the intertestamental stuff, and there's Raphael, but that's, you know, that's not scripture. There's two that are named in the Holy Scriptures that we know for certain, Michael and Gabriel. And that of these two, you have a very interesting dynamic where Michael always seems to be working for Jesus, and Gabriel always seems to be working for the Holy Spirit. So you have two, not three, and they're always working for two, but not the other, of the three persons of the Trinity. And then you got to, I mean, the question is, and this is where it's like a little dangerous, it's definitely speculation, but I think it's just beautiful. Where's the Father's archangel? And then you remember there's this other, like, highest of all creation, like the highest of all creation, the light bringer, let there be light, here he is, right? Lucifer, who, you know, who can dwell in the presence of God's inapproachable light? And in all those pieces kind of congeal, and it's, holy crap, it was one of the archangels that fell. That's who this guy is. And then, oh man, when Michael is spearing the dragon right at the end of Revelation, when the one by the authority of the cross is throwing down the usurper who thought he could ascend to the highest place. I mean, just all, to me, it just all rings so true, but it definitely is speculation.
I like it.
Yeah.
Now, to the second question, though, when this is, when Michael shall stand up the great prince, it's, you know, this is the language of the resurrection and so it seems to me like there's something happening in Daniel chapter 12 that is the same thing that's happening in Matthew 24. In other words, it's binding up into one the resurrection of Jesus and the second coming. It kind of puts them all together, and it all kind of comes to a head with the discussion of the abomination of desolation. Now, I've never known, and I don't know if I ever will, and know what the difference is between at the end verses 11 and 12, between the 1,239 days and the 1,335 days. I think it's a difference of 94. Days.
Well, see, mine has 1,290, 1,335. So you've even got probably a textual variant going on there.
Oh no, you're right. I misread it. I had in my notes the wrong thing. Well, you're right. 1,290, 1,335, the 45 days. My guess would be that this would speak of the crucifixion of Jesus, maybe even starting on Maundy Thursday, until the day after the ascension of Jesus. So that's the time frame there. And to note that it's in the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross that the sacrifices are ended, that the purpose of the temple has been completed. It's almost like, you know, Irenaeus gives us this beautiful picture of the Old Testament people of God, and that's the picture of the wheat field. And the wheat is planted, and the farmer tends to the seed. He tends to the shoot. He tends to the wheat as it grows. He looks after it and everything. But it's all for the purpose of the seed. And then when the seed has come, when the wheat has produced the grain, then the wheat is cut down and thrown into the fire. So the same thing now. Now that Jesus has come. Now that Jesus has been baptized, now that Jesus has been dead and buried and raised, then all of the stuff of the old covenant has fulfilled its purpose and is no longer needed. Now the intent of God was for the Jewish people to find their joy and their peace and their salvation in the promised seed, and thus to have life in Christ, not life because they were Jewish. But for those who refused, they were cut down and thrown into the fire, and that's precisely what we see in the destruction of Jerusalem.
I think that I'm not disagreeing in any way with what you're saying there. What I think also then if this whole chunk we just did can kind of show us, it isn't interesting that after the very story-like form of early chapters of Daniel, right? And everyone loves Daniel and the Lion's Den. It's awesome. You then have this string of really non-typological one-to-one prophecies. And I forget what the word is that. Proleptic? Is that right? No, that's not it. What is it?
Rectilinear.
There you go. Rectilinear. The string of rectilinear prophecies. That there is only one event that is, you know, you have one king of Babylon. You have one king of Persia, right? Rome, yeah, you got 10 kings, which now suddenly we're a little more fluid with that number, I think. But in any case, you have all of these one-to-one prophecies taking place, all of which we can see, we can tag them as fulfilled, with very few exception, leading up to Jesus appearing. The rest of which all either very, very neatly fill into Jesus appearing, his life, death, and his resurrection, right, on our behalf, his ascension into heaven and his beginning of the church. The only thing left unfulfilled is this abomination of desolation, which the book ends with and doesn't really explain it all, but then Jesus picks up on in Matthew chapter 24. But as you said a moment ago, one of these clearly fulfilled realities was a desolation of the holy place of the temple that occurred beforehand, which should tip us off the abomination of desolation is going to be, and is Jesus not talking about the destruction of the temple in the answer to his question, right? So when you see this thing, let the reader understand, looking at what Daniel has prophesied, there's going to be a desecrating of the temple by the blood of human beings and false worship or false pretenses of worship set up. Christians, when you see that, flee. And then capstone this thing with, look, they did. Historically, they did. And so there's almost, in my mind, there is no way to come to Matthew chapter 24, which we want to go back to now, where Jesus is saying this reality about the abomination of desolation. And as I try to talk and go there at the exact same time, it's a little bit tough. There is no question in my mind that when he makes this turn in the answer to the question, when will these things happen and what will be the sign of your coming, that the abomination of desolation is the sign they were to look for that the temple is going to be destroyed, not the sign they were to look for the end of the world.
Exactly right. So Jesus is saying in Matthew 24:15, hey guys, you've seen this before. The abomination of desolation has happened already. You know what it looks like. Now, when you see it happening again, run for the hills. And he's explicit about that. Let the one who's on the housetop not go down or take out the things that are in the house. Let him who's in the field not return back to get his clothes. Woe to those who are with child and nursing mothers in those days. Pray that it won't be in the winter or on the Sabbath, for there'll be great suffering, etc., etc. So Jesus, he knows what's coming because of Jerusalem's rejection of their Messiah. It's one of the reasons why he weeps over Jerusalem when he's coming in on Palm Sunday. And so now he warns the church and he says, this is happening. Now, when you see it, just turn your heels and run.
Now, I think that's exactly right. So that brings us to verse 22, which is another one of these places where people want to go to the end of the world then. He was just talking about not the end of the world, but they want to just jump there. Largely, I think, because of assumptions. He says, but it is weird. It's definitely weird what he says. If those days had not been cut short, no human being would be, now it's the word saved, and we want to read into that word saved, eternal salvation. I think this might be a little bit more about people escaping Jerusalem and living through the event, right? But for the sake of the elect, that's for the sake of the Christians, those days will be cut short. Now, which days are these, though? These are the days, I would say, leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. If he had tarried too long in destroying Jerusalem, Christians wouldn't have seen the sign because we'd forget what it was, like we have, and they would have stayed there and they would have all died. But instead, he keeps it short, keeps it within a single generation. Mm-hmm. What follows there is a series of warnings then, which makes a bit more sense. So actually, I'm going to stop there and just let you go on 22 because the next part is, I think, a little clearer. So what do you think about 22? Yeah.
No, I think that's right. And to remember that, I mean, we keep talking about August 10th, not 2070, August 10th, 70, that day, which I think one of the key things to getting these things right is letting that day and the horror of that day and the intent of that day kind of have its weight that it is held in the church and in the reading of the scriptures. But we can't forget that there was a four-year war that led up to those days. So, I mean, this all started in 66 and even before, but with these waves of attacks. And so at last, the Lord is shortening those days for the sake of the elect, so that some will, in fact, survive. But all these things are happening. And
now, in the go ahead.
So all these things are happening, and Jesus finally says, "Okay, finish it. Let it happen, so that some will survive."
And I think this makes what he says next just so powerful for our present day situation. I mean, you could take these words and apply them directly to our present day situation, but the fact that it was already happening then, I think, is all the more reason not to believe that someone out there is going to show you signs and wonders to separate them as new prophets of the end of the world. Then if anyone says to you, "Look, here is the Christ," or "There he is," do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders. See, well, everyone wants to say, "Well, that's the end of the world." No! This is in the last days of Jerusalem, right? This is a terrifying reality that it was even happening then. So as to lead astray, if possible, he says, even the elect. I think the idea is the elect technically can't be led astray. "See, I have told you beforehand." It's like, look, guys, right? So now you know what's going to happen. If they say to you, "Look, he is in the wilderness," do not go out. If they say to you, "Look, he is in the inner rooms," do not believe it. In fact, "I will not come again until this temple is torn down." That is a reality that he is promising to them at this point. Because when I come again, and now we do have a little bit of a hat tip to the very end. So I would say the next line is about the end, not about the destruction of Jerusalem, because that's the way my coming is going to be. It's not going to be out in the wilderness somewhere. It will be as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. And I love that image, by the way. Every time that there's a lightning storm, I love to watch the lightning and actually see it. But I also love how if it's on the other side of my house, I can still see the light, you know, in the, totally going the other direction. And so that's what, you know, when he comes again, there's going to be no mystery. There's no secret rapture, right? It's all one immediate reality. And then verse 28, he goes back to, though, but I'm talking about the destruction of Jerusalem right now, not my coming again, and where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. A proverb there's some debate about, but I think no matter how you look at it, the melancholy of the proverb is pretty disgusting, and that's what he's driving at here, right? That the destruction of Jerusalem, the abomination of desolation, this is a nasty time. You don't want to be there if you can help it. Get out when you see that sign of the desecration of the holy place, which, as I throw this back at you, Brian, make sure you try to put a stamp on that. So what do we think actually did that? What's the desecration?
Well, maybe a little bit before that, just because I got my finger on something here in the commentary text, is some more Josephus work. Who talks about the account of those days before when Jerusalem was under siege. And it says, "There were such men as deceived and deluded the people under the pretense of divine inspiration. These prevailed with the multitude to act like madmen and went before them into the wilderness, pretending that God would be there to show the signals or signs of liberty." And then he talks about the Egyptian who pretended to be a prophet and started from the wilderness with 30,000 men and ended in a defeat on the Mount of Olives. And then it says, "A false prophet was the occasion of these people's destruction, who had made a public proclamation in the city the very day that God commanded them to get up on the temple and that there they should receive miraculous signs for their deliverance. Now there was then a great number of false prophets who had been killed by the tyrants to impose on the people, who announced this to them, that they should wait for the deliverance from God." So Josephus gives us the account that, in fact, what Jesus promised is true, that all these false prophets were coming and tried to lead the people astray and did so to great horror. We went to visit Masada down in Israel, and that's this fortress that Herod built, and all of these people ended up down on top of Masada, and they were besieged by the Romans at last, and as the Romans were building this big ramp to come and kill them all, they decided that rather than being killed by the Romans, they would kill each other, and there's this great slaughter that happened at their own hands, until the last man killed the other man, and then he fell on the sword. And so when the Romans came over the wall, they found them all. They had food and water and everything, but they were all dead. I mean, all these kind of fringe groups were led astray this way and that way in this time. So the very thing that Jesus happens, that Jesus promises, does happen. So
it's like
maybe that's
Waco,
the
man.
first thing.
It's like Waco.
What's that?
It's like Waco. It's just crazy. So I want you to come back and hit, but isn't it interesting? So I said that there's ripples. I don't think we're supposed to look for this as a sign of the end of the world, but there are ripples of these kinds of events taking place where people set themselves up in the place of God. They create a desolation of teaching. They say, go off with us into the wilderness. We will find God here and we'll stand against the world. If you want another great example of this, I've recommended the podcast Hardcore History with Dan Carlin before. There's still one out there that's free. They go away after a little while, but it's called Prophets of Doom. And it's about the German city of Munster during the Radical Reformation and their attempt to create a mutiny against the empire. And it's just unbelievable, the false prophecy. It is something to be aware of and be warned by in these texts, even though I'm going to maintain the text itself is about Jerusalem's event, as you just kind of described. So again, bringing it back to, because we only got a few minutes left here,
Yep, sure.
The actual abomination, what was the sign? Where is this fulfilled?
Yeah, it seems like this took place under Titus during the siege of Jerusalem. And again, I've got another Josephus reference. It says that the zealots who were somehow in charge of the temple, you know, they had kind of taken control of the temple, they admitted for money probably a number of Idumeans into the temple, with the result that the blood of 8,500 people is shed in the temple. So we read in Josephus, these men therefore trampled upon all the laws of men and laughed at the laws of God, and for the oracles of the prophets they ridiculed them as tricks of jugglers. For there was a certain oracle of those men in the city, that the city should be taken and the sanctuary burnt by right of war when a sedition should invade the Jews. And their own hands, they should pollute the temple of God. And so they did this. So as far as I can tell, that it's happening, it happens before the siege. It's happening during the siege of Jerusalem, and there's a number of zealots who have taken control of the temple, and these admit into the temple the pagans for a price. And the result is they go and they desecrate, they murder thousands of people on the temple ground and spread this blood all over the temple. And that itself is probably as close as we can get to the event that is the abomination
of
desolation.
You have the Jews by their own hand killing their priests, right? Whether it's intentional or not. And if you can think about what the temple is made to be and what the priesthood is, even the unbelieving priests as they were, you don't really get further down the line of saying, you know, God, we don't want this anymore. And that's effectively what, you know, what it is. It's the end of all holiness in that place. It's like unto when the high priest tears his robes at the words of Jesus, thereby basically admitting he's not the high priest. Or when the at dawn, I think the way that John's text reads, at dawn, the high priest and the priesthood, they're all standing in the courtyard of Pontius Pilate, having not eaten the Passover, so now they've missed the Passover, shouting, "We have no king but Caesar." Right? You have these moments of just clear rejection of the covenant taking place, and where, since it's desolate, God's going to wipe it off of the face of the earth. That brings us, I think, fairly well through 15 through 28, of which the vast majority, we're both making the claim, is about those days. It's answering the first question about the destruction of the temple. Where we're going to find ourselves maybe having a little more fun is next time with verse 29 and following, and what this means for the tribulation of those days and whatnot. But is there anything you want to say to kind of close up this little event today and capstone it?
No, this is, and hopefully, I mean, I don't think this is going to be you know, subtle for the people who are listening. We as we wrestle through these texts, we want to let the scripture interpret the scripture. But we also want to be driven as we do that by the rule of faith, which gives us, you know, very kind of helpful guidelines about how we ought to understand these things. And so we start with the imminence of the return of Christ. And so then we're able to go back and read these things and to see them not in the newspaper, but rather in history. And to see that the things that Daniel prophesied, in fact, did come to pass. The things that Jesus warned of did come to pass. and that they came to pass, that God gave the word. How about this? That God gave the warning of these things so that he would save his people. So we see in all of this, I don't know, that we see law and gospel functioning. I mean, we see God threatening all of these horrible things, but not just, God just doesn't cause these horrible things to happen. He gives us a word of these horrible things before they happen so that these horrible things would not happen to us. So that we read Daniel and we read the words of Jesus and we see that in these words, the warning of these terrible things resulted in the saving of the Lord's people and their rescue from all of this trouble.
I think that's exactly right. I'm going to add to it. I think it also shows the fulfillment of these things, the prophecy that they're going to be and that they all have come to pass exactly as Jesus foretold them is also there. So that when he says, but concerning that day, no one knows, we would believe what he says. That there's going to be no knowing of the moment before Jesus Christ returns. You're not going to be able to see it coming at all, just like the end of this show.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes. And check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.